so I've been really focusing on the higher quality papers that to form this talk. And the first question I had is, what is it about our brains that may be activated or different when we have a negative response to somebody who's not like us? And when we looked into the different studies that I could get my hands on, it's remarkable, because if you're in an in-group, being, a group of people who are dominant in a particular culture or setting, they will have these really different responses in their brains milliseconds after seeing images of people who are in an out-group. And that really caught my attention. Then I started looking at the questions of how does this sort of automatic prejudice translate into behaviors that lead to things like racism? And racism, really, the way I describe it in my talk, it's a system. It's a system by which one race has privileges and advantages over another because of race. And the physiological effects of that are also mediated by the brain. There's a lot of stress associated with it, for example. There are changes in hormonal levels that can have really negative impacts on health and development. And so those are really the types of things I'm focusing on in this talk.
So as we think about, and now you're specifically really looking at prejudice, and then I come over with the word racism. It's not exactly what you're talking about, but it kind of is. So if I just have to put this out there. When we think about, say, prejudice, for example, we're often looking at a situation where, say, for example, a white person discriminates against a person of color. So as you look at the neuroscience aspects of that, are you studying the white person's brain or the person of color's brain? Do they experience it the same way? How I just have to put that out there.
Right. So again, just to kind of clarify that. So when we speak about prejudice, and this is something everybody's brain does, we see somebody who looks different from us and our brain reacts differently than when we see somebody who looks the same as us. And when we talk about racism, again, that's more of a learned behavior that happens over time through exposure to stereotypes on television, for example, in advertising, or in comments we hear from people in our families or around us. And it's part of this again, a system whereby we start behaving differently towards people as a result of the prejudices that we experience. And when we look, the studies that have been done on this topic that I'll be reviewing in this talk are studies where, for example, they'll have put a white person in a scanner, a brain scanner. We call it a functional magnetic resonance imaging, which has some strengths and some weaknesses, but the data that are really reproducible suggest that in cases where you have somebody who looks at a face that looks more like themselves, a white person looking at a white person, for example, areas that in the brain that are involved in facial recognition light up right away. If you put somebody who's a unfamiliar face, a person of color, then actually that's not the first thing that happens. Other areas of the brain light up, including areas that it can be associated with sort of threat-like responses. What's remarkable is that if the person has some familiarity with that face, even though they're not in their own group, then in that case, you start to get the facial recognition again. So it's remarkable that just a little bit of familiarity is enough to overcome this effect. But the effect is definitely there. The next question, though, is what do you do with that information? So if your brain is reacting to something as a threat, and it's not really a threat, it's just a threat because of this automatic prejudice response, can you overcome that and say, okay, this is not really an issue? And this is where the question of racist types of behaviors come in. There are people who do, and there are people who don't react that way. And again, that really boils down to a number of learned behaviors.
I was just debating this with some people yesterday afternoon, and we were talking about intrinsic racial bias, whether it's learned or not, and then whether it can be unlearned, or whether someone who is not just prejudiced but also openly racist, if that person could be educated to be not racist. And I'm not sure. I'm no scientist, and you are, and so I'm not sure what your take is on that, but can I ask you that?
So the prejudice part is something that's very difficult for us to overcome because it's, like I said, it's almost automatic. There may be ways to overcome it, but no one's really shown that to be the case necessarily. Certainly there are some people who react. If you have what we would call a more racist view of the world, this effect is much stronger in people who have those that level of understanding of the world. But it still happens in everybody. What's remarkable is, though, is what you were talking about before, the next step, you know, what your brain does with that information. And there's a remarkable study that was done at the University of Chicago where they brought young children into a room with two dolls. One doll was sort of beige-skinned, and one doll was sort of brown-skinned, but they were otherwise identical. And the very young children really didn't seem to have a preference for one doll over the other, or they tended to be attracted to the doll that was more like them. But by the time they were about age five, there was this incredible bias towards the white doll. They would ask the kids questions like, which doll would you rather play with? Which doll do you think is more trustworthy? And questions like that. And what was remarkable was not only did the white children have that preference for the white doll, but the children of color did too. And this is all very learned because we children, even by age five, are being exposed to so many stereotypes and so many, media-based images and words and everything else about people that this bias already starts to sneak in.
And having heard you say that, I want to shift the frame the tiniest bit and say, as you have looked around at who's doing research on this, who is researching it? Who's doing the most compelling research on prejudice and racism? I just have to ask.
Well, there's a large number of people doing it, and they're from all different backgrounds and all different types of science. So there's psychologists, psychiatrists, neuroscientists, behavioral neuroscientists. I wouldn't guess that there's really one group that's doing superior work to another. It's a huge community of people who are really trying to tackle this question. What's coming out of that research, I think, is that, you know, there's a lot of strategies we can use, as you mentioned before, to overcome this reaction if people are willing to do it. But at the end of the day, I think the hard message is it's going to require a lot of really tough conversations on the subject of race and a lot of really insightful thinking about how to overcome racist attitudes. So it's all possible. And the other thing that is really remarkable, as I mentioned before, this effect where just a little bit of familiarity overcomes this automatic effect in the brain. I mean, I think if we, these conversations need to be amongst ourselves within the one group or another, but also between groups, because that familiarity is going to be a huge way to overcome a lot of these effects.
Okay, now I want to dig into that concept of a little bit of familiarity. Be more specific. When it's at home, what is that called? Do you mean like meeting more people that don't look like you and interacting with them? Or
Exactly. I mean, if you're growing up in a community that is a community that's nothing but people that are just like you, then obviously you're going to have a lot of unknowns and a lot of fear about people who don't look like you. And I think this study suggests that literally just introducing somebody and telling them their name sometimes is enough to overcome this effect that we see in the brain. And that tells me that really we don't have to become best friends with people that are not like us. We just have to become familiar with them and comfortable with them. And that's true for every group. So that may be one way to do it. You know, become comfortable in your own skin, obviously, but at the same time, be comfortable with becoming an emissary for your group with another group and have those conversations and have those interactions. But if that doesn't happen, it's going to be very difficult, I think, to overcome the fear and the threat responses that we're seeing in these subjects.
Because I know that what a lot of people are focusing on right now is police accountability and police on community violence. And so people are all over the United States, probably all over the world, but we're talking kind of about the United States, are wondering what it would take to retrain law enforcement so that this perception and reality of people of color being disproportionately impacted by police violence can be shifted
around.
That's
a really interesting point. I actually was on a panel a couple of weeks ago with a number of people, including two policemen from Portland and Hillsborough. And we were talking, and it was like, you know, in the old days, you had the cop on the beat. You know, everybody in the neighborhood knew the police, and they knew people in the neighborhood. There was a familiarity there. They got to know each other. And now it's almost like they're, there's this institution of the police force, and there's this community that is being policed by them as opposed to cooperating with them. And I think community policing programs have been really great in that regard. I think those are great instances where people know each other, they get to know what's going on, to the point where, you know, you even know, like, this family's having some troubles, and maybe that's something, you're becoming part of the community instead of a force that's policing it. So I think those days of the cop on the beat are gone in most communities, and I think bringing something like that back, where there's much more interaction between the community and the police forces, that familiarity changes the equation in your brain about who these people are.
Wow. Okay. One last question. Dr. Larry Sherman, professor of neuroscience, going to be speaking at this really interesting event about the neuroscience of prejudice, as we've been saying. Who do you want to come to that event, and what do you want them to take away from it, if I could ask?
I would love everybody to come to this event, and I'd like everybody to think about it, because it affects, you know, everybody in our community in different ways. And I think the key is to understand that, you know, racism is just bad for everybody. It's bad for the victims of racism who feel that they're not, you know, getting the same opportunities and the same privileges that others are getting. It's bad for the racists because they're stressed out in a society where they think there's this constant threat. And in fact, I mentioned earlier these hormonal changes, the stress hormones. You know, our bodies were not meant to have high levels of stress hormones all the time. And so I think you can make a real case that racism is a public health problem. And, you know, having these high levels of stress hormones because of racism, either because you're, again, someone who is the victim of racism or someone who's engaged in racism or has racist thoughts, both of those people are going to be stressed out. And that has to change. I mean, it's a huge cost on our society in so many ways, including our health. So I'd love everybody to come and hear that.
All right. Dr. Larry Sherman, thanks a lot for taking a few minutes and talking with us today.
Thank you.
Hey, and best of luck in all you do.
Thank you so much.
All right. For KBOO News, I'm Lisa Loving.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Social Justice Action Center Open House, Tuesday, October 4th, beginning at 5:30 p.m. at 400 Southeast 12th Avenue in Portland. Rents in Portland are rising, and long-term grassroots institutions are being forced out. But the Social Justice Action Center is bucking that trend. The Social Justice Action Center will be sharing their model for grassroots organizing in the heart of Portland, especially by and for marginalized communities and organizers of color. There will also be information on getting involved with the center, a silent auction, music, and much more. Again, that's the Social Justice Action Center Open House, Tuesday, October 4th, starting at 5:30 p.m. at 400 Southeast 12th Avenue in Portland. More information may be found at KBOO.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of AFFECT, a community event about the work, culture, and design of social change. The conference will take place October 7th and 8th at the Ziba Auditorium in Portland. AFFECT will feature talks from Spawn on Me creator and podcaster Khalif Adams, Ferguson activist and social impact designer Dee Nichols, Nadia Gathers from Code 2040, and many more. Again, that's AFFECT, October 7th and 8th at the Ziba Auditorium, 810 Northwest Marshall Street in Portland. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
The time is 5:58 p.m. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next is Labor Radio.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Holla! And welcome to the Coalition of Black Trade Unionists segment of Labor Radio, highlighting the works of the working class, by the working class, and for the working class here on KBOO 97 FM, where the heart of the community comes alive 7 days a week. My name is Deborah Hall. I'm a member of the American Federation of Teachers and the current Secretary Treasurer of the Oregon Coalition of Black Trade Unionists. Our president, Tina Turner Morford, could not be with us tonight. And as usual, I'm joined by my sisters in the struggle.
Hi, I'm Dr. Audrey Terrell. I'm the Vice President of the Oregon Coalition of Black Trade Unionists. I'm also retired executive from the United Auto Workers in Detroit, and also president and CEO of Dr. Audrey Terrell Institute.
Hello, I'm Andrea Lemoines. I am a member of the Coalition of Black Trade Unionists. I am also a coalition organizer for Portland Jobs Bush Justice, and I'm actually the equity chair for my union, CWA Local 7901.
All right, and that is the Communication Workers of America.
Thank you.
Thank you,
yes,
Andrea.
So not everyone knows what CWA is. Yeah.
Thank you. Tonight, our segment will be highlighting the upcoming election and a couple of the ballot measures for our voters' consideration. We have with us in the studio this evening from the Yes on 98 campaign, Brittany Worley, field organizer, and a gentleman who in this neck of the woods needs no introduction, but here I go. We have Tim Nesbitt with us also. And we also have Monique Coleman, who teaches marketing and business for the Beaverton School District. Representing the Yes on 98 campaign this evening, we have Andrea Lemoines, who is a coalition organizer for Portland Jobs with Justice and also a member of our Oregon CBTU. Welcome, Brittany, Tim, and Andrea, and Monique for being with us. And thank you for your time this evening.
Thank you. And actually, I'm